Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast.
Hi, this is Dick Staub with another in our Journeys series, conversations with thoughtful creatives and cultural influencers on their life, work, and personal journey. Today, an interview with the late Rich Mullins.
He's always been one to march to the beat of a different drummer, which is one of the reasons that I like him already. After finishing a BA in music education, he headed off to teach on a Navajo Indian reservation, which is kind of not a non-traditional path. Reunion has just released Rich Mullins' collection Songs, and prior to that, Brother's Keeper contains some of his most original and fresh material yet. Welcome, Rich Mullins. It's nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
Wasn't that a huge introduction?
That was
a mere mortal.
I'm so impressed.
I know, I stumbled over it anyway. But I did, you know, work it out very carefully. Let's start with the most recent news first. What is Canticle of the Plains?
Well, let's see. It's kind of a long story. Are you ready?
We're ready.
Okay. It started when I was in a senior in high school in 1974, and I saw a movie by Franco Zeffirelli called Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because the next summer I was camping out in the Ozarks, and I was hanging out with a bunch of people I'd met, and there was this guy, and we started talking about movies, and I said, you know, that I had seen Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon 3 times, and he said, don't go back and see it again. I had a friend who was a banker, and he saw it 4 times, disappeared, mm-hmm. and the guy had gotten a letter from him a couple months later, and he had gone to, he was living in a Franciscan mission somewhere over in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I never did that. See what Christianity looks like, not from my real narrow experience, my own narrow view of it. I've become really interested in the whole monastic sort of experience and all that. And Beaker, a guy who I've co-written with for about 10 years, and I were reading about that and kind of going, man, that sounds like it'd be a great time. So the problem was, you know, we don't even have the guts to be Catholic, let alone be, you know, involved in a religious order. So we sort of started a mock order. It was a little bit of a joke. But the idea was to try to follow that kind of thinking. The three traditional monastic vows are the vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of going, man, one of the problems we have is we're sort of out here just making Christianity up as we go along. We don't have any kind of orthodoxy. We don't have anything that, you know, we take the Bible verses that we especially like and we enjoy them, and the Bible verses we don't like, we say that it was just, you know, Paul was hung up about this or
culturally context or
right.
All this.
And so we decided to take church membership more seriously and try to think of ways to be integrated more into the body of Christ. And then we decided, you know, we had neither one of us had a date for several years at the time, so we decided we, you know, if we're going to be celibate, we may as well make a religious big deal out of it. And poverty has always been an easy nut for me to tie because I have trouble holding on to money. So we decided one of the great things, you know, it's always bugged me all this stuff about tithing, you know, because I kind of go, man, there's not a mention of it in New Testament except in somewhat negative terms. And why is it, if money is the root of all evil, why do we think that we're doing God a favor by giving him 10% of it? Wouldn't we do ourselves more of a favor if we gave him 90% and only kept 10% of this evil root?
Mm-hmm.
And so we tried to figure out, you know, what do most people live on in the United States? And let's live there or under. And then the rest of the money would go to, you know, projects that we're interested in or, you know, organizations, that kind of thing. So it's been challenging.
Now, how did this work itself into Canticle of the Plains?
Oh, that's right. Well,
and what is the Canticle of the
Plains? That's all background material. Well, since we weren't going to be Franciscans, but we really liked St. Francis of Assisi, we decided to reinvent him as St. Frank of Wichita.
Good.
And so we invented this whole character, and we were kind of going, let's just make up a guy. I mean, let's see what... If you took, you know, those elements of Francis' life that made him a real, that made him the sort of character who probably single-handedly caused the Renaissance.
Yeah.
What would he look like if he had lived in 19th century America?
19th or 20th century?
in the 1800s.
Okay, okay.
I have a real problem with that, too.
Yeah, well, it's the numbers thing. It's the money thing is numbers, too.
Yeah, so, you know, we thought, you know, and we figured he'd be, you know, he'd live on the frontier, he'd live on the edge.
Yeah.
Probably be more interested in a just dealing with Native Americans than, like, say, the government.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, who wouldn't be? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Only we had a real problem figuring out what's he like? Like, what does he look like? What does he sound like? How does he move? Then I went back to Friends University to finish up my music ed degree, and I met Mitch McVicker.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and I said, man, I just met Frank.
Okay.
So Mitch has joined us now, but at the time I didn't even know he was a musician. I just knew that he was he had a quality about him that seemed very, very much like what Frank would be like, and we studied him, and we built the character, you know, of Frank of Wichita
on Mitch.
On Mitch.
This guy sitting right over here.
Yeah. So, yeah, doesn't he look saintly?
So this is tell me about the production.
We wrote 10 feature songs.
Yeah.
Just because we're pop Christian artists, and you always put 10 songs on an album.
The formula.
Yeah. Formulas are nice, though.
Yeah, you know, well, they give some bookends, some definition.
Right, yeah. And you get a formula down, and then you can fill in the blanks. And it starts with his conversion, which happens at the end of the Civil War.
Cool.
And then we put a whole lot more metaphorical stuff in it. And he takes off on a journey to Dinabakeya, which is where the Navajos are from.
Mm-hmm.
And they're searching for this place that they think is imaginary. And then in the end, they don't even get there, but they realize they've been there all along. So it's very...
A little Pilgrim's Progress kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a little... It's kind of foofy, I guess. I don't know.
No, I have no idea.
You've already talked a bit about what it says about your own spiritual sojourn.
Uh-huh.
You're trying to get to some first things, some basic things, some important things.
Right.
Where did the thing about the Navajos come from in your life?
Because I live with them.
But I mean, how did you, where did that come from? Why did you decide to do that?
Well, because I wanted to go to Asia, but it was so far away. and I spent a summer there. And the thing that I enjoyed about being in Asia was that I noticed, and this is, you know, this is, of course, a real oversimplification of what really happened. Sorry, I talk with my hands. But what I basically noticed was that the Asian Christians had underlined all the wrong parts of the Bible.
Like persecution and that stuff?
Well, like instead of underlining the part about you must be born again, which Jesus said one time to one guy who was specifically hung up on being a Pharisee.
Right.
They underlined the part that said, sell all you have, give to the poor and follow me.
Yeah.
And I was going, you know, and then all the good Christian American people were trying to straighten him out and say, no, you're supposed to have some kind of ecstatic experience and build your faith on that experience. And they were saying, no, it's not about experience, it's about obedience. And there was this thing going on, and I started going, I don't know which side is right, or if either side is right, or if the truth is actually somewhere beyond all that. But the thing that happened for me was I began to, being there, like one of the things I noticed in Asia was that in Thailand, brides wore red.
Right.
And I understand they do in China, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, red to us seems like, you know, the color of adultery. But to them, it's the color of fertility. Well, it's interesting to me that in China, families are only allowed to have one child now, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But they still wear red at their weddings, mm-hmm. which is very similar to in America how brides still wear white here, although you know, a significant number of them aren't necessarily mm-hmm. pure.
Join us for the continuation of our conversation with Rich Mullins tomorrow. Thank you for listening to Journeys on the Kindling's Muse.